Welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast, Season 2. This season, we'll again hear from the experts. These experts are social engineers and open source intelligence investigators. Sometimes, they'll tell us stories about their experiences, and sometimes, we'll have some questions for them. We hope you'll enjoy them.
Welcome to this episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have a very special guest with us today. We have Micah Hoffman. Hi, Micah.
Hey, Patrick. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for being here. Can you give our listeners a brief introduction of who you are?
Absolutely. So my name is Micah Hoffman. I go by WebBreacher on Twitter and most social media platforms. I am pretty big in the OSINT community now with being the president of the OSINT Curious Project. I also run my own consulting company. I teach for SANS, the SANS Institute. So I have my hands in a lot of different buckets right now.
One of the reasons that I wanted to have you on here is because people will often ask, how do I get started in this field? How do I get started into an OSINT career or a social engineering career? And it seems as though you've come a long way to be able to get to where you are. So I thought it'd be fun to talk with you a little bit about how you got to where you are. Would it be a good idea to start at the beginning? Like, how did you get into the IT security field from the beginning?
Oh, wow. From the beginning. Okay,
From the beginning.
All right. So here we go. So my path into OSINT is really quite convoluted, and I attribute a lot of the decisions I've taken and the steps I've done over the years to really two things. One is taking advantage of opportunities, even if they're ones that ultimately are short-term wise, don't look like they're going to necessarily be what I want to do, but long-term, they get me into a place that is going to help me get where I want to be. And then the second thing is, with the world of open source intelligence and social engineering, what they are, and cybersecurity, and just in general, there's so many opportunities for us to follow the things that we are interested in after hours. And I know this is one of those things where people are like, oh, I don't do this for my day job and I want to get into the field. Well, you know, a lot of what we do can be done and learned after we clock out of work. So let's start in the beginning. So I went to college and I knew I wanted to be a psychologist. I got a degree in psychology. And in my last year there, I decided I hated psychology, just absolutely hated it. So imagine my surprise when I was in my final semester of my senior year and I'm like, okay, well, I've got this graduate school lined up already. I'm already accepted into this PhD program in cognitive neuropsychology. And gosh, I hate the field. So I could either go back to school and continue on or take my adventure where it took me. So I went to grad school, went there for 2 years and really, again, hated the psychology part, but loved the concreteness of the things that we were doing. We were analyzing places and people in rats' brains where they were learning and when they had memory. So we would do some medical procedures on rats. And then we would test them in psychology. And what I found was at this point in my life, I had that transition. I wanted to go from the abstract to the concrete. That's really what I was looking for. So I decided to drop out of my grad school program and pursue my dream to go ahead and get into med school. So I went back to the undergraduate world and did a full year of biochem, physics, and calculus, 15 to 18 credit hours for an entire year. And it just was incredible and just exhausting experience. Long story short, I didn't get into med school. You know, along the way, I learned stuff about myself that I really am a highly motivated person. I like doing things. I like things in the medical field, but I also like the concrete things. That was really solidified for me. And I'd always been one of those people that loved to tinker with computers. You probably remember, you know, people back in the 90s and all that were like, hey, I can fix your home computer for you. Sure, let me defragment this and it runs fast. I'd always been that person for my family and friends. And so I was working at a hospital and just helping out, and I knew that they were going to be cutting my hours in the hospital, just downsizing. And I was working the night shift, and in the mornings I would go out and play 9 holes of golf, and I'd usually have the course all to myself. It was great, you know, just a nice opportunity to be out there in nature. And one day the starter paired me with 3 people from a company, and we started talking. I knew my hours were being downsized, and the people said, you know, so what do you do? I'm like, well, I do this. And they're like, well, could you sell computers? I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I could sell computers. And so at that point I accepted a job, and that was my first office job, selling computers. And from there, I'll speed this up. I went from selling computers, which I hated, to doing the tech support for that small company. I loved doing the tech support because computers were that concrete thing. I did this, I saw that. You know, it was logical. It wasn't easy, but it was rewarding. So I transitioned to tech support, and went into help desk at another company, and then from there went into servers and real IT, Unix system administration, then router switchers and firewalls, and then I took my first SANS class. And that opened my eyes to the world of cybersecurity. That was probably back in 2007-8, and I felt the power of really the attacker, the cybersecurity attacker, and how if things were not configured right from the system administrator point of view, I could get in there and grab all of the sensitive things, and I loved it. That's when I decided that I was going to pivot my career from Unix system administration into cybersecurity. And that was a hard change for me. You know, a lot of people nowadays, and actually over the past 15, 20 years, I've heard say, I want to be a pen tester, and I want to, you know, I get the cert and I can be a pen tester. And back when I was coming up through the ranks, I was doing Linux system administration, and then I knew that I wanted to be in pen test because I'd taken this class and I felt so powerful. Then what I had to do was find some path into cyber, and the path into cyber for me was doing something I really didn't like doing. It was doing certification and accreditation, which was non-technical, just interviews and checklists and writing reports, and I absolutely hated it. But I did it, and I knew that I could parlay that into something else. And so at that contract, I did the CNA, and then I started talking with some of the other people in the office, and they're like, hey, we could do this wireless stuff, this wireless assessments, and we really don't have anybody. Could you build a program? Like, can I? Yep, I just went to another SANS class. So I built a program doing wireless assessments, and then from that transitioned into full pen test. And from that, I did a whole bunch with pen test and cybersecurity for years. And then I decided that, you know, hacking into web applications and systems wasn't as exciting as it used to be. It wasn't that it was too easy. It's just that I wanted to do something new, new area for myself. And I remember very distinctly, we were doing penetration tests of people's systems. And one of the steps in our process was, when a system was on the internet, facing the internet, we would go and perform Google searches on the name of the application, on the developers, on that, just general things. And I remember doing this reconnaissance, and I Googled the name of the application, got a PDF document that was essentially a help manual for how to use this application. It's like, all right, well, I'll just read it, you know, like we always do. And so I was reading through this manual, and I was like, wow, you know, it's here, it says, you know, go to this URL, and if you want to log in, enter in your username, like this user, and it had a username. And then it said, enter in a password like this one. And I'm like, you're giving me a sample password. So I literally went over to that URL, typed in that username and that password, and I was in the application. I'm like, holy cow, talking about, and this application was one that I had authorization to pen test and to gain access to. I don't want anybody to think that I just logged into some random application, but I was like, this is, you know, this is another one of those powerful things. I Googled, I got a doc, I read it, and it told me what to do. And I thought, this is incredibly powerful. So I started shifting from web pen tests to open source intelligence. At that time, as I've heard many, many other people say, I didn't even know the word OSINT, but I knew that I wanted to get more into recon. So I did the pen test still, and I tried to make opportunities for myself to get into the world of open source intelligence. And it took a while. But during that time, I set a lot of different goals for myself, from becoming a better Python coder and learning more about the world of OSINT, making some tools for the community. And so I did a bunch of things, like made a bunch of modules for the ReconNG framework. I added some modules to the Nmap project. Okay, I added one module to Nmap. But I did these things. I made my own tools. And what I did again was cyber by day. And then at night, for 4 to 6 hours, I would work on my private tools, the things that I enjoyed working on, that I loved working on, my passion, if you will. And that was incredible. I mean, it was a neat time of learning for me. And it wasn't just learning to learn. You know, we sometimes study for a certification so that we have to learn. You know, I was learning about things that were interesting to me, that were exciting to me, and discovering that people outside of the world of pen test did this reconnaissance too. And that's when I started really opening up my eyes and getting involved with other groups, getting to know other people like Dutch OSINT Guy and TechNizette and some of my good friends now. And at that point, what I did was I took my knowledge that I had honed of penetration testing, reconnaissance, those things, and I helped present that to the OSINT community at the DEX XL conference over in the Netherlands. And I remember, you know, doing these things that as a pen tester I'd done for years, you know, using the command line interface to ReconNG or running this brute force, you know, website enumeration tool like Burp Suite Pro or something. That was simple to me. But when I showed these techniques to a different audience, to those people in law enforcement, those people that had been doing open source intelligence mostly in their browsers, they were amazed at the ease at which you could do these things. And they kept saying, teach me more, teach me more. And that was where I really found a home. You know, I had skills that I could bring to the community table, but I also knew that in the OSINT world, they had things to teach me too. The whole world of social media exploitation and even a lot of other areas. So that's really where I got started in OSINT. Nico, myself, TechNizette, Laurent Bodo, Ben Strict, and Sector 035 did some OSINT work together at that conference. And it was there that we decided that having a trusted source in open source intelligence news, blog posts, and things like that were important to us. And so we created, or that was the dawn of the OSINT Curious project that I now run today with those people. And you know, I along the way I made a SANS class, which caused me to learn so much more about open source intelligence and really about the audiences that might take the class or might use those skills. It's incredible when I have a new instructor coming into my class saying, hey, I know OSINT. I'm like, great, you know, tell me about this. And they tell me about how they use OSINT. And then later on, I'm like, well, how do you think this type of person might use OSINT? And they're like, well, I have no idea. I'm like, well, how about that person? I have no idea. And they're like, well, in the SANS community, the OSINT community, and just in the OSINT community in general, we have to talk to or be able to talk to all these different people, not just OSINT in law enforcement, OSINT in social media exploitation. And so it's a constantly evolving field. And I love all of the wonderful conferences and trainings and blogs and tools that are out there that really have blossomed over the past few years, sharing tradecraft tools and techniques. And so just to finish off the career, several weeks ago, I had this guy from Layer 8 that said, hey, I want to interview you about your career. And here we are, Patrick.
It seems as though you have a very atypical path into this. I don't think you would recommend to anybody to go to grad school to be a psychologist and then apply to med school in order to get into this. So in one way, that's a very atypical path. But in another way, it also seems like a very typical path, where when you talk to a lot of people in this field, they don't have just a direct, I went to college for computer science and then here I am. It seems as though many people are coming from different directions, and either they fall into it or they just somehow eventually figure out that this is the direction that I wanted to go, much like you just described.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the strengths of the OSINT community is the diversity in background. You know, I draw on my psychology sometimes when I create a tool to exploit username enumeration across multiple websites. I did that because I knew the psychology behind people reusing usernames. We do this. It's something that I've talked to people about many times in talks, in private mentoring sessions, that it doesn't matter what you've been doing. That's your background. That is your foundation. We can build OSINT or cyber on top of that and teach you the specific skills. And don't feel bad that you were in mechanical engineering or in nursing and now you want to get into OSINT. That's actually a strength, because you're going to look at these situations, you're going to look at these opportunities a little differently than we are. And that's sharing those kinds of insights is extremely important to strengthening our community.
I was speaking with Shane McCombs from Innocent Lives Foundation about how they might do social engineering. And you just brushed on it a little bit, where you said you used your psychology to figure out username reuse. Are there other places or other examples where you think you've used your experience and your background with psychology to do a little bit of social engineering, which might not be directly at a person, where you're not really trying to exploit a person directly, but really you're trying to get inside how people think and figure out, like, this is what people might be doing either as a group or individuals, and how has that helped you in your field?
What I think has happened over the years is that in each of the positions I've been in, whether it's been education or whether it's been in an educational setting like in psychology or in pre-med, I've learned different things. In psychology, way back years ago, I focused on learning about how people work, what drives them, how they communicate, how they interact with others. In med school, I learned how we actually function. And cybersecurity and IT allowed me to understand how systems work. And pairing all of those different things together really does help me be more effective. I've done several social engineering engagements in my time, and I will absolutely say that understanding how people work helps me be more effective. And also, you know, it helps me work better with others throughout the years. I mean, we all do things outside of our careers. I taught parenting classes to small groups of people for 5 years or so. And I just help people work more effectively with their children in it, through a nonprofit. And, you know, just working in small groups and being able to facilitate and being able to talk, that helped me with my speaking. That helped me when I'm talking in class. So, you know, there's all of these extra things that we do along the way that are not necessarily fully focused on your career that come into play and will help you with your career when you get there. And I think it's understanding that just because I'm not doing what I want to do right now doesn't mean that I'm not making strides to it by doing these other things.
You also mentioned this a little bit earlier, and I've heard from some people who say that they were doing OSINT before they even knew of the term OSINT. Was there one person that introduced you to the term OSINT? What was your realization that, hey, this OSINT thing, that's what I've been doing. That's part one of my question. And part two is, who are some of the people who have really helped you to get into the field?
So for the first part of the question, when did I realize OSINT was OSINT? I'm not exactly sure. In certain parts of my life, I can point to a specific event and said, this is the thing. I don't think that there was a specific event that allowed me to understand, hey, OSINT is where I want to be. It is the name of the organ of the discipline that I want to work within. I can't think of the time. And as far as the people, we share a lot online about our role models and the people that have taught us. I'll say in the beginning of my time in the field, I did what a lot of other people in OSINT do, and I read a book by Michael Bazell, and that helped me understand what the potential was out there. But I found that that book was very limiting because it was a book. It wasn't necessarily interactive, like Justin Nordine's OSINT framework and all the things that people were sharing or not sharing, speaking at conferences and talking to the speakers like Kirby Plessis or Nico Dakins or other people helped me build those relationships with people that really helped me grow as far as myself personally and professionally. And that's one of the things that I love about these virtual conferences that I know Layer 8 is doing and other people are doing, is that the barriers to interacting with the speakers are so much lower now. You can just instant message them in whatever chat application they're using or send a tweet to them. And I've always tried to reciprocate, because those people that helped me out by responding and saying, hey, Micah, let's talk about this, those people helped me out. And so over the years, I've always tried to help others as well.
I think when people are first starting out in OSINT, they sometimes latch on to tools because tools can make things very easy. What is your thinking, or what would be your advice on tools versus learning the strategies and techniques that are behind the tools?
We've actually had this discussion several times on the OSINT Curious projects, live streams and webcasts, that tools allow you to work more efficiently, allow you to gather more data and possibly analyze it and see patterns a lot more effectively than doing things manually. However, understanding how things work, understanding what the tools are doing, so that if those tools break or are ineffective at doing whatever it is they're supposed to do, or just the tool goes away, as we've seen with some websites that were out there that were publicly accessible, then went behind a paywall or something. We need to understand how things work, not just that they work. And so in my classes, in my trainings that I give, you can go on YouTube and look at all the different videos that I've given where I try to explain the hard way, what a tool, what a process does, and then I'll show you the easy way. Because, yes, we could do things the manual slow way and still achieve the same result. It just takes more time and more effort. So tools, I'm absolutely in favor of. I just always suggest people learn what they do and how they work before using them, and that way they can stay effective when they go away.
Do you have any favorite tools currently that you like to recommend, or any new ones that you have created?
I do. My favorite tools right now are Firefox and Google Chrome. Now, as an OSINT person, those are my main tools, my web browser. No, but to be very honest with you, over the years have found myself having to prove people that what I say matters, whether it's in a penetration testing report that we found some vulnerability on somebody's site and they're like, yeah, but what's the worst somebody can do, then me having to prove it through exploitation, or whether it's in the open source intelligence world. I'm sure that you and many of your listeners have created a really in-depth profile of a target, and you see the risk in what's happening or what's being done, and you know how you would exploit it or how somebody else would exploit it to take advantage of the person or the situation or their access. And you convey that to a person, they're like, yeah, that would never happen. And you're like, yeah, it really could. So a lot of the tools that I've written are to demonstrate, you know, how people might use things. For instance, one of my favorite tools is the Untapped Scraper tool that I wrote that analyzes the social media application Untapped, and looks at somebody's drinking behavior and what they're sharing. And while that's a very niche side piece of work, the writing of the code to the analysis has been extraordinarily insightful. I'll give you an example. I wrote this tool called Untapped Scraper. It's a Python tool on my GitHub, and you give it a username that of a person that has a public profile over on the Untapped beer drinking website. And when people have the Untapped application, they take a picture of whatever beer they're drinking, then they rate it, and they say, at this date, at this time, I drank this beer in this location with these friends. And I saw, and people would get badges. And I saw Phil Hagen from the Sands Institute tweeting out one time, hey, I drank the most lagers in this place. And I was like, hey, man, you're sharing this with everybody. And he said, well, what's the worst that somebody can do? I was like, ah, okay, challenge accepted. So I wrote this Python script, and then eventually some very smart people turned it into a web application. And what it does is it pulls the data from a person's profile, then aggregates it and analyzes it. And it'll tell you the days of the week, the hours of the day, the days of the month when people consume their beers. It tells you where. It will create a heat map, a Google map of where they say that they're drinking. And, you know, that was my proof that this matters. And sure enough, I've had many people say, okay, because of that tool, I've changed my behaviors. And that's terrific. But, you know, what I find, and you might find this too, Patrick, is that you do one thing and then somebody throws you a curveball. I had one of my students come to me at one point after I introduced them to this, you know, niche tool. And they said, well, could you use that tool to watch a location, to watch the bar? You see, we work at a classified facility or a restricted facility, and every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we leave our office and we walk across the street and we have some beers. And if my colleagues are logging, hey, at this date, at this time, I'm in this location, and you can find that pattern of life that Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they're in this location, that's important to know. I thought, let's take a look at that. And so, you know, it's being open to feedback and being open to other people's ideas that have allowed me to continue to learn and grow. I created this Untapped Watcher application that you tell it a location, and it will gather over days, weeks, months, years, who logs beers there. And so since 2019, I've been using this tool to watch who's been logging beers at over 70 different airports around the world. And so since before COVID hit, I was watching as people logged beers in Narita Airport or in places in the US or in Europe. And, you know, it's interesting because I found that I do these things just for myself, right? I do this because this is interesting to me, but then at some point it becomes important to other people. And I was able to do an analysis of the decrease in air traffic based upon beer consumption and logging of beers on the website. Because when those COVID restrictions hit in March or so of 2020, there was a dramatic decrease in the amount of people that were logging beers in airports. So it goes back to something I mentioned in the beginning, that many times doing something that you think is important, that you like doing, because for the sheer joy or interest in it, will pay off sometimes in ways that you can't understand. And so answering this one question for my student and changing things and doing some research just for the sheer joy of doing it, not because it was going to land me a job, not because it was part of my work, has allowed me to grow and understand more things, like people drink in airports. And there goes back to the psychology too, right? It's people drink in airports. And so with this one application, this one tracking of people as they go through the world, I can now look at a person with an untapped account, see that they checked into one airport at a certain date and time, see they then flew to another airport at a certain date and time, then use my original tool to pull up their profile. And there are some people that have a drink at the hotel when they check in, then walk a couple of blocks and they have a drink at another bar. So using this combination of tools that I developed over the years, we can actually track people as they move throughout the world, which, again, I had no idea. That was not my original intent. But because I was curious, sought to learn, and created these tools, it had some unintended positive outcomes.
I think the place that my brain went to as you were describing those types of things is also going to be with regard to privacy, where people are voluntarily giving that information out. And like you said, what's the worst that can happen? People might not necessarily understand how much information that they're giving out. For example, if they're logging all those hours that they're at the bar, they're also logging hours they're not at home. And there used to be, I think, a thing on Twitter that was like, please rob me, which would kind of track of when people were away on vacation, meaning I'm not home right now. Or even how you just described where people would use Untapped at various hours of the day. I'm now picturing what if an employer decides to put all their employees into your script and see, oh, Bob in accounting is having three beers at lunch a couple days a week, and potential privacy issues with that. Where do you kind of see the overlap of OSINT and privacy issues?
So to your specific point just there about employers and about privacy, absolutely. And I've given talks over the past bunch of years about Untapped and using it as kind of a case study. And one of the exact cases that I show is, hey, let's pull up this user's profile. It's just a random user's profile. And you can see, and we look at the hours of the day when they drink. And sure, it's localized to the person's mobile device. So wherever they are, that's the hour. And, you know, seeing when people are drinking, consuming most of their beers between 12 and 5 p.m., that might, you know, getting into the psychology, that might indicate that maybe they are working an alternate shift at work, or maybe they're having long lunches, or maybe they're, you know, this is one of the things that I love about open source intelligence is that nothing is really cut and dry. You know, it's not one thing leads to the other. There's always possibilities, and understanding humans that, you know what we're seeing is people logging beers on websites. We're not actually seeing them drinking the beers. So the fact that somebody logged all their beers from 12 to 5, that might mean that they had extra time at work to log those beers that they drank the night before. And so the analysis of the data has really started to come to the forefront of the conversation, because having the data and going, oh, this person's drinking beers, not necessarily. So I always stress in my talks, in my classes, that what we see is not necessarily as easy to interpret as before. Now, to your exact point of privacy versus open source intelligence, reconnaissance, I look at it as an inverse relationship. As your profiles become more private, the amount of open source data that's out there about you decreases. Right. A great example, again, is the Untapped. When a person creates an account on Untapped and they don't take any action to privatize their profiles, what happens is that I can use these tools to scrape the most recent 25 beers that they've drank. But if they enable that privacy bit to secure their profile, I can't collect anything on their profiles. And so that's what Phil Hagen ended up doing, is making his profile private. And so when they do that, it becomes more challenging to OSINT them. The other, you know, way of thinking is the more open a person is, the more opportunities there are to collect on them. So, you know, in the cybersecurity world, we've had a lot of questions over the years, should we be publishing hacking tools, penetration testing tools, because bad guys are going to get it, and bad guys are going to use those tools that we've created for good against unknowing people and victims. But we still do it because the benefits of releasing those tools are outweigh the possible chance that somebody's going to use it in a bad way. So in our world, you know, I'm still teaching the open source intelligence processes and tools and creating things because I like reaching those people that are trying to learn. And if I can reach them and help them understand what we can collect so that they then become more private, then I think that it all fits together very nicely.
One of the things that I've been trying to learn a little bit more about is things like micro expressions and facial expressions. And one of the additional pieces that goes with that is how you also really need to understand context with that. And I'm thinking it's probably similar with OSINT, where a lot of times OSINT could be just data, where if you're missing the context, as you just described, if somebody is logging all these beers that they drank from 12 to 5 p.m., it would be real easy to just kind of assume they're drinking on the job. But when you put in the context, like, no, they just had free time and that's when they were logging them. Is that also something that you teach to people to don't just look at the data that you pull out of OSINT, but also try to better understand the context of the information that you're getting from it?
Absolutely. In my OSINT class, and I know in many other classes, we teach the differences between data, which is I ran a tool or I collected something, I have the raw data that I collected, information, which is that data processed, and then intelligence, which is applying your customers, your mission requirements and objectives to that information. And in my class and in my talks, I always try to show that progression because you're absolutely right. You know, understanding the context can help us understand what we're seeing. And I have many examples of how that's been done right or wrong. And other people do too. I don't know. You probably know about Benjamin Strick, the amazing BBC open source intelligence analyst, as well as geolocation person. I mean, he himself talked about one of the things that has helped him to geolocate some images or videos is the context in which they were found. It's not just the image. It's, okay, this was extracted from somebody's Twitter feed. Let's go back at John McAfee's previous posts and see where he was in that place. Because if I can understand that, then I might be able to understand this one. And we have context in a lot of different areas within OSINT, whether it's understanding people's behaviors and to understanding what they're posting and how organizations work, or in disinformation and misinformation as well. So yes, understanding and being open to possibilities. Another thing that many open source intelligence classes, including mine, teach is errors and analysis. You know, we teach about false dichotomy. Oh, it's either this or that. And I spoke recently at a conference and I mentioned how I actually have made several errors in logic in my career. And one of them I remember quite clearly. I was given a research opportunity to look for my target, which was a male, high value target. And my goal was to, you know, research his social media profiles and conduct open source intelligence research on him. And so I went to his Facebook page and there's a picture of him and his wife and three adult children. And I'm taking pictures and downloading images and scraping all that data. And then I go over to his Instagram and there's a picture of him, a different woman, and three young kids. And, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh my gosh, he's cheating. He's a polygamist. You know, there's all these things that are going. And it's really challenging for many of us to sit down and try to brainstorm all of the different reasons for this. And sometimes all we need to do is perform some additional context research, dig a little deeper. I dug a little deeper and I found that on Instagram, it was his sister and his nieces and nephews. Nothing nefarious, nothing out of the ordinary, but it's sometimes our biases and the way we look at the data that can misinform our assessment. So yeah, I absolutely talk about interpretation of data and analysis. as a big part of what I do.
You used to give conference presentations on imposter syndrome. And
yes.
I know that comes up from time to time. And I know there's many, many people in our field that feel that. Where did that come from? Why did you come up with that presentation? How did that all come about?
So imposter feelings is something that I've had, I would say, I've been working through for probably about 10 or 11 years now. You know, it's interesting because when I was coming up through the, I gave you my whole history here, when I was coming up through the IT world and fixing people's Mac computers for some government organization or setting up a Windows server, I was just doing the work. And then at some point, I think when I got into the world of cybersecurity, I started looking at what other people were doing. And I think this was really the turning point for me. When I was setting up servers, people were sharing, you know, documentation, set up a server, you can do this, you can do that. And I was like, well, great, that's terrific that we can set up servers or turn on these services or whatever. It was more concrete, it was more sanitized, but it was just documentation. Then I started getting in the world of cybersecurity and seeing people that were expanding the field, doing all of this in-depth research, this novel work, this uber work about things I had no idea about, assembly language and exploits of microcontrollers. And I had no idea this stuff even existed. And it was overwhelming to me. So when I was doing certification and accreditation or doing my excellent work in wireless assessments, it didn't measure up. It didn't measure up to what these other people were doing to move the field forward and just in interest. I had created a really solid program in, I remember this, I was doing those wireless assessments where I would war drive and war walk around and collect wireless signals, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi from devices that shouldn't be in certain places. And it was a solid program. It was very useful to the customer. I had done some efficiency things where I could take the Kismet XML data and just upload it. And I created a web application to analyze and plot and deduplicate. And when I looked at that work and compared it to some of the things that I saw those rock stars in the cybersecurity community doing, it was crap. And it made me feel terrible. Even though I was providing a great service at high quality levels, I was measuring myself up against other people, and not just other people, but other people way far ahead of me in the industry. And then I started going to more cybersecurity conferences. And in 2012, as I speak about in the talk that I think you're referring to, in 2012, I remember going to DerbyCon over in Louisville, Kentucky, and listening to people like Mubix, Rob Fuller, Chris Gates, Carnal Onage, and H.D. Moore, some really capable, competent, self-confident people that are just incredibly smart. And I started measuring myself up against them, and I was like, what am I doing here? I'm not even in cybersecurity. And I started thinking about leaving cybersecurity. And I literally started looking for jobs outside of the field because I was feeling that bad about myself, not through anything that Rob or HD or Chris or anybody else has done. I later learned that Rob Fuller and Chris Gates and many other people in the cybersecurity community are so willing to share, are so supportive and just great down-to-earth people. Many of them became my friends, but it didn't matter. My perceptions were that I was inadequate. And I think that's really what started me on the path to imposter feelings. And to be honest, that's what drove me so many times to do more, to practice more, to perfect things more, to do a lot of the things that I've done more recently. And, you know, at some point I was able to take a pause and reflect back on my career and reflect back on the things that were making me feel uncomfortable about the open source intelligence world, about things that were happening. And I really figured out that it wasn't them, it was me. And it was how I was interpreting things. And I saw a great presentation on imposter feelings. And I decided that, you know, this was a message I wanted to get out. And I was very thankful that besides DC and some other conferences were able allowed me to present, because, you know, sharing my story, that continues. I still have imposter feeling and feelings of failure and stuff, even though I run several companies and do all of these other things. I still have those fears. But my message, I've been very lucky to get feedback from people over the years that have told me that it made a difference in their lives, that it helped them through a situation. And knowing that me sharing has helped one person was all worth it.
So you mentioned at the beginning of that you felt as an imposter because you were seeing people that were pushing the field forward. I would say that you have pushed the OSINT field forward. So what advice would you give to people that look at you and feel imposter syndrome? Because you're now on the other end of that, and I'm sure there are people out there, and possibly even people listening to this, that look up to you in the OSINT field and probably feel like imposters when they look at what you do. What would you say to them?
You know, that is something that I realized several years ago, that I'm now part of the problem. But my message from that talk remain consistent. There are steps that you can go through, or anybody can go through, and I continue to go through to minimize imposter feelings, and that's keeping a track of what you are doing, keeping a track of your progress, so that you can look back on it when you're feeling down and go, you know what, I might not be doing what that guy's doing, but I've done all these things, and I'm no longer the person I was a month, a year ago. Also, one of my biggest suggestions, which is so hard, is don't look up, but look down. Don't measure yourself against other people in general, but if you are, don't measure it against the people that are, you know, that are farther along in their careers than you are. I have people that come out of college that are like, you know, I have no idea how I'm going to get to where you are. And I'm like, don't worry about getting where I am. Worry about learning, and then share that learning with people that are where you used to be. Look at the people that are following you in your footsteps and teach them, help them grow. Because when you become able to teach a subject, you've got greater mastery than just, oh yeah, I know of that. And so over the years, one of the things I've tried to do is to teach, whether it's through the live streams or whether it's through my actual teaching classes or whatever, it's teaching other people. So when people come to me and say, hey, I think I have imposter feelings too, I'm having these things, I always try to reframe their perspective. Don't measure yourself against me or Mubix or Patrick Laverty. Measure yourself against yourself and your previous work, and note progress. But yeah, ultimately, the hard part is that we can, for many of us, I can say those words, but it's very, very hard to put that into practice. And I get that. I still get that to this day. I did a talk last week at the wonderful NCPTF conference, and that conference, I had 75 minutes to talk, and I was tweaking my talk even the night before. I'm like, oh, I got to make this simpler. Oh, I got to do this a little bit deeper. And you know what? During the talk, I had two disconnections of my network. I had all of these things go wrong. And after the talk, I was just like, that was terrible. That was absolutely terrible. I let myself down. How next time I'm going to get triple backups for this and that, and all of those feelings of fraudulence, all of those feelings of just I let people down came into play. And I had people reach out to me and say, hey, that was awesome. That was incredible. I had no idea I could do those things. I had been doing things like that on these sites, but I had never looked at it from that point of view. And I'm like, really, you got that even with the two disconnects? They're like, oh, don't worry about the disconnects. You know, the material was sound, and how you presented it was good. And so, yeah, I mean, this is something I constantly work through. And if you're going through it too, shoot me a message. We can commiserate together. I'm open to direct messages on most social media platforms.
So you're also an instructor in OSINT. How can people learn from you? What, you mentioned that you're a SANS instructor. What classes do you teach? How can people take those classes with you?
Oh, and thanks for letting me talk about it. I am a SANS instructor. I'm a senior SANS instructor. I've been teaching at SANS since 2013, and I created the foundational open source intelligence class called the SEC 487 course, the SEC 487. And what it does is it teaches not basic OSINT, but it teaches foundational OSINT. So we go through everything from the things that we've talked about here about operational security and setting up platforms to social media exploitation, geolocation, image analysis, dark web, breach data, and more. On the SANS website at sans.org/SEC487, there's a redirector that will take you right to the page. And the class is running in on demand. It's also running in live in person and live online. I'll be teaching a live class in person in Vegas in September, but there are online classes even before that. And there are scholarships that are available to people. I know that your audience is probably filled with law enforcement and other people that might be interested in going to sans.org/free. And in there's a scholarship section, and you'll notice lots of different scholarships for different groups to reduce the cost of the class. But, you know, in addition to that, I run the OSINT Curious Project. I'm very thankful for the people there that allow me to help get good, solid open source intelligence live streams, blog posts, and things out for free to people around the world. And we have the OSINT Summit also, which is a conference similar to the Layer 8 conference that I've enjoyed attending and speaking at in the years. So lots of ways to learn.
And you also, a few years ago, created Spotlight InfoSec. What is that?
That's right. That's my consulting company, small consulting company that allows me to do open source intelligence consulting for people, usually for companies. And helping them with whatever they need help with as far as open source intelligence, high value profiles, high value target profiles, and more.
You're a busy guy. You also have OSINT Curious. Do you want to tell people who might be interested in OSINT what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. If you haven't heard of the OSINT Curious Project, we are a group of international, pretty diverse people that are, I hesitate to use the word expert, let's say very experienced in the world of open source intelligence across many different industries, whether it's law enforcement, government work, business, OSINT, dark web, and even things like genealogy and psychology. Our goal is to educate for free, and we do that through our blog post at osintcurio.us. It spells out OSINT Curious, or you can go to osintcurious.com and it'll redirect you there. We have everything from blog posts on a huge variety of topics to live streams. In fact, the week of the 19th of July, I will be doing a live stream at 1800 hours UTC. And you can just visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheOSINTCuriousProject and watch us participate in the live stream. We try to, you know, there's other organizations out there that train with a serious eye towards OSINT and the seriousness of it and the weight of what we're doing and all. I like to look at it more as a fun place, doing fun things on our live streams, like playing the GeoGuessr geolocation game and doing other fun things like that. So we in OSINT Curious look for places where we can interact with the community. And that's where the Searchlight Discord comes into play. The Searchlight Discord is a free Discord server that people can join. It's like Slack, and they can come and just join a community. That's another one of my big things that I tell people that are just getting into open source intelligence is, you know, it's fine if you reach out to myself or Patrick or other people, we're going to give you advice, but my main piece of advice to you is to join a community of other people where you're going to get a huge number of a variety of results as far as what what the answers to your questions are, or resources and tools, or just ideas. Join a community, whether it's mine or Searchlights or somebody else's, because you'll learn from other people easier and maybe even quicker than you will from people like me.
Speaking of quicker, one of the things that I like that you did with OSINT Curious for people like me with a very short attention span is the 10-minute tip. What is that all about? How often do you put those out?
Well, that actually is the combination of psychology along with training. Back when I was working at a previous employer, we had done these short video snippets of just, hey, let me teach you something really quickly. And because we knew that people have busy days, and being able to sit down for an hour and listen or watch something is sometimes not a luxury that people have. So I carried that forward into OSINT Curious, and we have 10-minute long videos that teach everything from what is a user agent and which ad blocker I should use and why, to how to do geolocation or how to do searches on social media or how to protect yourself. It's 10-minute long video series of free videos that are in our video catalog on YouTube that people can just visit and learn at their own pace. I like to think of it as kind of like the Matrix. You remember, I mean, the first scenes in the Matrix where Neo Dakins is in the Matrix. No, I didn't mean that, but where Neo needs to learn how to do something, so they just upload stuff to his head, or Trinity needs to learn how to fly a helicopter, and so they just upload that in her head. That's what these are. It's a video library of skills that you might not need right now, but coming to a place where you know that people aren't trying to sell you something, people aren't trying to persuade you to do something, just giving you the honest, here's a way to do stuff. I thought that that would be really useful to the community, and a lot of people rely on those for their OSINT work.
Awesome. If people want to get more information from you or get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
So I'm on Twitter. I know that a lot of people have Twitter accounts. You can find me at Web Breacher, that's with two B's, at Twitter. You can also send a message to OSINT Curious on Twitter, or if you're not there, I'll give out my email address here. You're welcome to give me a shout at Micah@osintcurio.us. You're welcome to give me a shout and let me know what's going on in your life and how I can help you out with that. Okay, within reason.
Awesome. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for doing this, Micah.
Hey, Patrick. Always a pleasure talking with you and sharing with your audience. And I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. You can find out more information about us at layer8conference.com and find more podcast episodes on many of your favorite platforms. We hope you enjoy these episodes as much as we enjoyed making them.